So this is how much of a professional podcaster I am. Dimes and I have been talking for like 15 minutes, and I realized I hadn't pressed the stream, go live on the stream button.
You know, so funny. Like, I was saying what I thought were pretty good jokes.
Amazing riffs, points.
And I'm looking over at the chat, and I'm like, nervously, I'm like, am I bombing? This isn't going well at all.
And ladies and gentlemen, as messieurs, welcome to 2-Bit Podcast of the channel. At the end of the day is the show. I am your host, Jason Marinchuk, and I am joined today again, Dimes. This is like deja vu with Mr. Dimes from the Blood Satellite Podcast. Hey, say hello, Dimes.
Hey, I'm trying. Like, we literally were doing the show for 15 minutes, and then Then it was Cooper. You know, I could tell when my guys are here stirring the pot. And he's like, 15 minutes? I'm like, oh, shit.
Oh, well. You missed out, kids. But that's all right. We were getting a good stretch on. Where were we?
Well, I mean, you were asking me if you want me to answer the question. I can make it shorter this time about, like, what red pilled you.
Hey, Dimes, what radicalized you?
Well, what I was saying before is I was just, interestingly enough, thinking about this earlier today. I don't know why, but I was thinking about the idea of someone being entirely radicalized or red-pilled and stepping outside of the status quo entirely, because most people don't. Most people are really just radicalized on a couple things, and they might be very, very radicalized on like one or two things. But I think it's tied to like where you grew up and when you grew up. So for me, in Canada, I'm in my mid-30s, you know, interestingly enough, you know, I would have grown up in a time when you would have seen liberals more comfortable saying slurs. And even like my friend Thomas 77 might point out, it's like you would see rock stars, pop stars playing around with swastikas and things like that. So it was always blurred where the line is on what was acceptable. And that was just seen as rebellious. But I think the thing that might have radicalized me, you'd mentioned something there. Maybe we'll get to this again. You'd mentioned Stephen Harper. And I remember back when Stephen Harper was Prime Minister of Canada, there was this big controversy where he had used the phrase old stock Canadians, trying to sort of dog whistle, I guess. But everyone got really pissed off about him using that phrase old stock Canadians. Like, well, what do you mean by that? Oh, you mean white people, right? But like, to me at the time, I never really witnessed that within my context. I'm like, well obviously there are people, probably English and French, who can trace their lineage back 10 generations. Like, yeah, like those people exist. Are you denying they exist? And then that was sort of the first domino where everything kind of got crazy after that. But that would have been a long, long time ago, this, like pre-Obama, pre a lot of that shit.
Yeah, it was like 2014 was Trudeau's election. I remember because I voted for Trudeau. I was pushing for him. You know, first Gen X prime minister, yada, yada, yada. And Stephen Harper was a creepy day manager. So I was like, no, we got to get rid of this guy and put fresh hotness in. And I wasn't even a pot smoker. So like the pot thing didn't like it enthrall me. And then, but I figured he's going to be, his dad helped write the charter, all that stuff. He's going to be a defender of the charter back when that mattered, and our magic piece of paper. And then he just shit all over it with Bill C-16. And it was around that time, too, that I was like starting to see. I think it was the Harvard thing. Remember the Harvard? It was a kerfuffle at Harvard over like Halloween costumes. And there was a video of the time with like this young college age kid yelling at the dean or whoever the hell he was, like some like higher up. Telling him that, no, this place is going to be like, it's supposed to be a home. You're making this an unsafe home. And she's just having this freaking meltdown over someone wearing like a native headdress thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or something like that. And I remember seeing that and talking to my now ex-friend, Emily, about it, because she was going to university at the time. And I was like, what the hell is going on with this? Like, is this going on in universities? Like, what's happening? And she's like, oh, yeah, no, don't worry about it. It's you know, it's marginal. And then flash forward, like literally a month and a half later, and she's like talking about ending the patriarchy and like how meritocracy is like is bad. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. Quick, and even within my own family, and I'm trying to date myself here, but I saw, like, back, I talk about back in the day, it ain't back in the day, but like pre-Tumblr, because Tumblr was what kind of gave birth to the social justice warrior, that whole thing, Gamergate and all that. But even before that, I saw that percolating with members in my family, where like one day they were getting really into Aboriginal art, and they started using words like patriarchy, almost before it was cool. And I was paying attention to where they were getting it from, because it was coming through their friends.
Yes, the old Aboriginal art to progressive pipeline. Like,
you just, yeah, because first of all, you know, I'm gonna
dream make... catcher. You get a dream catcher, and then all of a sudden you're like going to gay clubs and like going, well, I hear these glory holes are great. Like, it's just, it's almost that's yeah. just like the Canadian way. You know,
they were originally invented for a totem pole. It was ceremonial. You could just, that's the thing. That's what be so great about being those types of people. You can just make shit up, and then no one knows anything about Aboriginals. They say, yeah, probably. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like, that whole two-spirit thing is hilarious. So people don't know, in Canada, you got the LGBTQ, all that stuff. But then there's also this thing that's, I've done my research, is essentially made up, which is called two-spirit, which is they read some old books, because no Aboriginal tribes had any written language until, well, they had phonetic language invented by the settlers in the late 1800s. But they said, oh, there's oral history of this thing called two-spirit, which was like, oh, they're
very oral.
Kind of. Yeah, exactly. No, like, where's all the oral history on like how they had sex? No one's asking those questions. No one will fund my shit. But then, you know, they two-spirit became this thing. It's like, oh, they were the original trans people, and now in Canada, two-spirit comes first. So it's 2SLGBT,
which is so Canadian, right? Because it's like, you have to differentiate yourselves from being Americans. They're like, oh no, the Americans are LGBTQ, blah, 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 blah. No. In Canada, it's TS, right? Is it TS or
two? The number 2S.
Two, and, right?
And I got to deal with that every day, where there's people out there, legitimate people, saying, you know, Canada pioneered gayness. And I have to be like, shut up.
Well, no, but that's true. We did. We pioneered it. We are freaking gay. We are the gayest. We are the gayest of the gays. Like, I live in Australia now. I'm a Canadian living in Australia. Australians aren't gay. They're stupid, but they're not gay. Like, they're just like, they're herd animals. Like, you could literally distract them with something shiny. They're like, we have magpies here. Yeah, spirit animals. Like, they're just like, it's, I've told this story with Matt Erickson before, but like, if you're so in Australia, everyone walks, okay, so if you're going forward to some destination, you walk on the left, right? So, like, you know, it's like you drive on the left, everything's on the left, on one end or the other, right? If you're walking in Australia, just like on the sidewalk, and you happen to stray into the right-hand lane on the sidewalk, and someone's coming towards you, they don't know what to do. There are no improv groups in Australia. They get stunned. They're like, and there's like, so imagine the scenario. I'm trying to paint the picture, right? Here's a sidewalk. Here, so there's a left-hand side and a right-hand side. Here's me, right, on the right-hand side. Here's someone coming over here, and they just look at you like, what are you doing? Like, you could walk around me. Like, imagine being in a field, right? And you're like, but there's, what?
You know what's funny? Yeah. This reminds me of a story that I think about all the time, and it didn't happen to me. It happened to a coworker at one of the agencies I worked at. But he was a bit of an older guy, like a Gen Xer. At the time, I was younger than him. But then he telling a story, kind of a smaller guy, very industrial, dressed like an industrial guy, like the lead singer of Health, if anyone knows that. Anyway, he was telling a story where he was just having a rotten day, pissed off. He's walking down the street, and it's just him, like at night. No one else is around. There's this other guy walking towards him on the street, and they got caught in a classic guy moment where, like, neither were going to move. And they could just tell from the stance and positioning, he's just like walking towards him. He's like, you know what? I'm not going to fucking move either. I'm taking a stand for myself today, right? And then they just kept going towards each other, didn't move. And it just ended with them standing in front of each other, just staring at each other silently. Like that had never happened socially before. Like, your operating system doesn't know what to do.
Do they just start making out? that's the only
any,
move left.
Anything could happen.
Just like
maybe tongue. They start making out. Maybe they go and they find someone else to make out with together. Like, you don't know.
Right?
No one wrote a script for that.
They go find a native person, like two spirits.
Yeah.
Let's introduce this two spirit thing. Like,
I'm making out with the girl half. No, I'm making out with the girl half.
I'm the catcher. I'm the pitcher. I'm the catcher.
The old Abbott and Costello routine. Now, you made a good point there about Australia not being gay, which is difficult because one of the larger, and I mean pun intended, cultural exports was Hannah Gadsby, the comedian who did Nanette, if you recall that. Lesbians Nanette, right? So
what a fun time that was. I watched about 15 minutes and I was like, I got better shit to do with my life. Like, I don't need to hear this woman do 15 minutes of hate and call it a comedy special. Well, it's like, this is like spoken word. I don't know if you, because you're in your mid 30s, so I don't know if you experienced this so much. But back in the 90s, there was like a resurgence or a renaissance, perhaps. Of spoken word, of slam poetry, all that stuff, right?
Oh yeah, and, I was, guess what, I went to those. I got I got the scars from that shit.
I mean, even to the point where like spoken word albums were big. Henry Rollins had a bunch of spoken word, yeah, which were like part comedy special, part him just ranting. It was like,
by the way, if people want to have just a straight up rotten evening, go look at that. Go look up at like Henry Rollins complaining about electronic music
for like an hour and a half.
It's so fucking bad. But the packed theater.
Yeah. Just packed.
I'm not doing songs anymore. I'm doing rants.
I miss when Henry Rollins was relevant. Do you remember his TV show that was like, I don't know how long it went for, but part of it was him typing on a typewriter, like hate mail to like open letter, like, dear CBC, I hate you for all there's like,
you know, what's funny? Like, I bet Henry Rollins deep in his soul thought he could be what Joe Rogan is now.
Right.
He was going to be tough guy, counterculture guy, believe in sort of outside the mainstream stuff. And now he's, who the fuck gives a fuck on Henry? He looks way too cool to be a guy that lame. And everyone figured it out. No one's excited to see Henry Rollins at all anymore. Where is he?
Right. Yeah. Well, I think the last time I saw him, he was on Rogan and talking about how he just like occasionally just picks up destination on the map and goes there and like goes, lives there for a bit. I'm like, cool. I still like Black Flag. Are you making more albums? Like, what do you like? It's weird when
he's a guy who goes on vacations professionally and wants to make it sound like a fucking ayahuasca trip. No, you just went to Brisbane, asshole. It, like, he's a guy, he has to live his life as a guy who looks like a Marine and is just the biggest pussy you've ever met.
Because he's there in Phuket having like, you know, street meet and like and writing his little Yelp review. Like, really, have you gotten this gay, have you? Like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
those tats are sagging, man. Like, but I remember what was it? Henry Rollins had that one album that was a complete banger, like I'm Not That Guy, and it was his second or first or second solo album after Black Flag. And it was like, it was everywhere for a bit. Like, he was super relevant, but he was relevant in the same time as Annie DeFranco. So it was, yeah, a weird time, you know. Like, it's like you had like these two dichotomies: hyper queer, like Lilith Fest person, and Henry Rollins. I was listening to both of them at the same time.
Yeah,
it's kind of a weird thing to keep in your head.
You had this archetype of the rebellious lib. And you, right, have people trying to do that still. Bill Maher would be a guy who desperately wants to still be a rebellious lib. And
I remember when that show was relevant. I remember when his first, was it, I forget what it was called. The one who got canceled for after his comment about the terrorists in 2001. Why is my brain not working? He's good. Dimes talk.
2001 was a great time because I was really, really into, you know, old Howard Stern, old Opie and Anthony. We were talking about this before the show.
Right.
And if you didn't live through the few years immediately after 9/11, you were really missing out because you saw some people say some wild shit. Now, it wasn't what some people claim it was, like a Muslim hate fest. It really wasn't. I remember it. In fact, people went out of their way not to hate Muslims. And you probably haven't seen many movies where Muslims were even the bad guys after that. Like the closest you might get is like something like Homeland, but then they go out of the way to like explain that way. But you did see a lot of like liberal comedians kind of lose their mind around that time. And I was watching, there's this show I loved hosted by Colin Quinn called Tough Crowd.
Yes, Tough Crowd.
If anyone was like an Opie and Anthony fan, you had your early Bill Burr, early Louis C.K., mm-hmm. Patrice O'Neill, all those guys that people still talk about now. But it was just like Colin Quinn, and it was all 9/11 shit. You can find, I used to watch this shit all the time because you can find it on YouTube, and there's commercials from like 2005. So you get the full retarded millennial experience. I don't know if I can curse that much on here. I apologize.
Oh, you can swear like a sailor. It's like, I think you passed the first like 30 seconds and then YouTube's fine with it. I don't know. I've decided to like not worry about YouTube.
Yeah. But yeah, Tough Crowd, I love it. And a lot of it still holds up. Early, like Marc Maron was still not great back then. So you can see him. You can see all these comedians who just didn't get better since then too. So if you're into that shit.
Let's talk about Marc Maron for a second. What the fuck is, how is that guy a guy? How is a guy a thing? I've never understood it. Like he's kind of like who was that comedian who just passed away, who's Jewish, but his whole thing was being a Nebbe Jew and like I'm depressed and I'm always like yada yada yada. I forget his name. It'll come to me. But he just Marc Maron was like the model of that, and I've never understood him. I've never like not in terms of, like I get his comedy, but it's not comedy. It's just like him talking about. Yeah. Boring about I'm dating a younger girl now. I'm like, of course you are. You're in your mid, I think at that time, is mid 40s and you're Jewish and you're living in California. Of course you are.
Like, I'm dating a younger girl now, of course. And my cats, like that's it. That's every right. Different. But that's here's the thing. So he epitomized a type of entertainer that I really think is falling out of fashion. I'm taking a big swing here, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's that I think sort of the confessional comedian has fallen out of favor. And he actually kind of saw that fall out of favor with Anthony Jeselnik. Like like a lot of like the 1-2 punchline guys came back, but Marc Maron was the Louis C.K. was this early on too. And kind of still is, but getting up there and just like drama dumping or whatever it might be. And then I don't think that plays as well anymore, partly because comedy is too big and it needs to collapse soon. And these comedians need to go away into a grave. There's too many podcasts, too many comedians with too many fucking shit coins that they're running. Right. But like he was this like archetype, and that was what got him into his podcast, which it's him in front of a mic complaining about his life not going well. And there was a time, people forget, there's a time when that was a new type of thing. You didn't see a lot of that. Hearing someone just confess and be open about, like, my career's not going well. Dan Harmon was big on that, the creator of Rick and Morty. We're going off. This is not intended what I intended to talk about at all, but I could go off on this shit for, like, hours, too, if you need to. But, like, I go deep onto Dan Harmon.
Richard Lewis was – thank you, Book. Richard Lewis is the comedian. I was thinking about that. It was sort of the proto Marc Maron, where, all he did was kvetch. Like he was just. By the way, I'm taking Yiddish as I'm claiming it
as a defense mechanism. I know.
No, it's not a defense mechanism. I'm saying fuck him. I'm taking it. Like it's mine now.
I'm learning Yiddish for self defense situations.
So you can pass as.
Yeah. Everyone should learn combat Yiddish. Just have a
doily in your pocket in case, just so you can just like skull capper.
Like I'm teaching my kid self-defense Yiddish, he's not going to go beyond a green belt because I'm not ridiculous, but he's going to know enough.
Yeah, a little Schitzka, a little Schwetzing, oy vey. Like I grew up in Montreal. I grew up in Montreal, and I worked in Westmount for a long time. And if people don't know, Westmount is like, what would you say? What was the Beverly Hills of Montreal? It's like where all the rich people live. All the prime ministers have houses there. It's all the old money. So it's like Scotch Irish. And Jews. That's the demographic. And houses start at $1 million for a townhouse, you know, kind of thing as they go up the hill. So I worked at a restaurant for a long time there, which is sadly is no longer. But
I used to work at a dreidel store around there, yeah. just a store with dreidels.
Straight from Israel.
See, it's hard to tell when something like that lands if this is the beer or the lack of sleep, but I'll take it.
Oh, it's a bit of both. It's fine. I just imagine a dreidel store. What do we have? Dreidels. It's for all your dreidel needs. Come on down. Come on down for Shecky's Dreidel Emporium. Look at these. What do you need? What do you
call attention? What do you need? A dreidel? Kingfield had verbal Krav Maga. That's a comment that I endorse.
Yes, for all your dreidel needs. Where was I? Richard Lewis, Mark Maron. Fuck Mark Maron. When do the gays get so gay?
You know what's funny? It's that if you watch old movies from the 90s, like a lot of the progressive lib movies, there's gays in the movies, but they were almost exclusively flamboyantly gay. So you'd have gays, but they were, I guess, like it was just cool to do that back then. But yeah, they were there as like just comic relief. And then we were all like, okay, that's kind of funny, I guess. Like I remember this... there's this movie with Matthew Perry. I don't know when it would have come out. I want to say it's the 90s. It's called like 3 to Tango. He's there with Oliver Platt. And the whole premise of the movie is he wants to fuck this woman. He worked at like an architecture firm. He wants to fuck this woman at work, but he has to like, he's looking after his boss's girlfriend. His boss for some reason thinks he's gay and he wants to get with the girlfriend, but he needs to keep pretending he's gay. So it's just like a movie as a pretense for whatever gay stereotype you can imagine. But yeah, you could just do that back then. So it kind of came in by degrees, I guess.
I mean, you could almost be excused back in the 90s, 80s and 90s for not even knowing homosexuals existed. Like, you got called gay on the schoolyard, but it was more like you're being a fag. You know, like you're just like, it's like the Louis C.K. bit. You're just like, you know, people from Phoenix are called Phoenicians. Like, stop being gay. Like, faggot. Well, geez, just stop.
This is what I would say, because I remember that bit. And I know it's like South Park tried to make a big thing about this. Like, oh, it just means like an annoying person. But I'm like, sure. But the examples and mannerisms would be for a flamboyantly gay guy. Because if you give an example of like, oh, here's a gay thing to say, it is something like homosexual men would say. Which is like kind of effeminate, kind of nitpicky, trivial, and just like, you know, just and the fact of the matter is that a lot of guys found that repulsive. And that's kind of the implied thing that people don't want to admit, which is that, oh, that sort of behavior bothers a lot of guys.
We put up with it in women because we want to have sex with them. But in a man, as a heterosexual man to another man, you're like, I'm not putting up with that. Like, no, there's no money. Like, what are you doing? If I want to get nagged at or hear stupid conversations, I'll talk to my girlfriend or wife. That's untapped resources of I ask a question and I get a story and I have to sit through there. Cause if I say anything like, okay, what's the point? Then I'm the bad guy. Like that's the world I live in. And look, I ramble and I talk and all that stuff on these things. But in real life, I'm like more like, I just asked you where I should put the bag. I don't need to hear where the bag came from. I don't need to hear like any other context of the bag. I just, where do you want me to put this? And then I have to hear a 20-minute story about how your day went. I'm like, that's not the question.
They still and again, a lot of people, younger people, Zoomers don't realize this. If a woman was doing that to you back in the 90s, you could just grab her and throw her in the side of a dumpster.
Yeah. You could stab her at least 3 times.
We were chucking.
It'd be self-defense.
Yeah. You just throw them around.
Yeah.
Just you didn't need to like hurt them. Just throw them around.
Mm. Hurting them was off. Ever since the 70s, you couldn't hurt them. You couldn't hurt them since. Did you grow up with these? I'm sure you did. Where like, you know, the women's spousal abuse ads would run on TV. And like talking about, you know, women's hospitals, like if you need to get out, there's help, you know, in that NPR kind of voice. And those were on TV all the time. It was like, you know, do you know where your kids are? And also if you're getting the shit kicked out of you and you're a woman, hey, there's options, right? Like that was the two main things that I grew up with. And then like, and then later they added on like Mothers Against Drunk Driving and shit.
Fuck that.
I was actually even thinking about drunk driving. And here's an interesting segue into other conversations, I guess.
My audience is very happy that we got to drunk driving. All right, go ahead.
No, here's the thing, right? So I think there's like this is the difference. Here's a differentiation to get into drunk that I think we can establish. So you think of drunk driving, a lot of people think of will approach the problem of drunk driving as like either looking at the drinking or the driving. And the people are kind of inferred, but never addressed. So a lot of people hear, like, okay, there's a problem with drunk driving. Drunk driving is a problem. People are dying from drunk driving. Some people look at the drinking and try to limit people's ability to drink. So they'll go up to the restaurants and say, and the bars and say, look, you know, impose all these rules and regulations, make everyone fucking liable. Impose harsher sentences for getting caught, all that kind of stuff. And other people look at the driving thing is like, no, we have to make cars better. So if people are doing this and we can't prevent, you know, everyone from doing it, we'll prevent better cars. We'll build better cars so that they, people will survive crashes better and that kind of thing. No one actually addresses the people problem, which is like, I think this is where me and my crowd, I'll include you here, Dimes, is looking at things a bit differently, is that, no, we have to address the people. And it's like, well, why are people driving drunk? Because implicit in that decision is simply saying that I don't care about my personal safety or the safety of others. I don't care about civilization on some level, right? Because, and I know whatever, like, you know, libertarians are going to spurg about this, but there's a responsibility to other people and yourself, including your family, when you start taking high risk behavior. And I'm not talking like, you know, going, you know, whatever, is it 0.5? Okay, well, you're 0.6. I'm not talking something stupid and gay like that. I'm talking like drunk, right? Like people like, you know, stumbling out, I can drive, you know, that's fine. Where's the road kind of thing? That's a decision that says that I don't give a crap. Like you have to address that. Like that's almost key to this concept that Matt Erickson and I shout out are building, which is like this idea of civilizational capital, where people need to inhabit a sort of a civil frame in order to build things and build things that are decent and good and just and worthwhile. But that comes down to the person. Like there's a quality that you're almost selecting for, and if someone doesn't have it, you have to find a way to build it or to encourage it.
Yeah, now this is a very, very serious topic. I'm going to take it seriously. However, I'm going to start with what I was going to say at the start, which is, sure, drunk driving kills many people, but compare that to how many drunk drivers truly live. And balance those out. but to be serious, yeah, drunk driving is a symptom of a different sort of problem. That, and you could break that data down in a few different ways. I like how many people are just occasional drinkers who drunk drive. Very, very rare from what I've seen, versus alcoholics who drunk drive. So it's more of an extension of an alcoholism problem. And what alcoholism deep down is, because I haven't had a drink in 3 years. So full disclosure, I used to be a pretty heavy drinker and stopped. And one thing that if you quit drinking, it's usually because you've identified that you have a problem. Now, everyone has a different way to define that. Some people, their rock bottom is a lot lower. And some people, their rock bottom is death, and you never really know. But you've identified there's a problem, and then so you try to identify what the problem is, because it's usually not that I just like drinking too much. It's that I like being drunk, and I like being drunk really fast. Okay, so what's that mean? Does that mean you like in other areas of your life, you try and race towards the extreme? That's a different sort of problem with your personality. Maybe you don't need to necessarily go to therapy for that. You can address it yourself. But once you understand what this is, then you can actually tackle it. But if you just think like, oh, I drink too much, then you're kind of white knuckling it. Then you're always wanting drinking because you think you can like outsmart it. But what you really have is perhaps a nihilism problem. Perhaps what you have is I've got other self-destructive tendencies. And this is one domain where my self-destructive tendencies is turning into outward destruction, as they often do. Oftentimes, self-destructive tendencies drag everyone down with them. And, you know, we can talk about Gerard about a mimetic crisis, because everything is connected. And so part of the drunk driving is that, like, you don't believe you're connected. And this is more to your point and perhaps Matt Erickson's, which is that you just think you're this nihilistic, sovereign individual. Nothing matters. I don't matter. Why not? You know, it's like you said, you get by in the wheel because you actually just don't care. And it's not obvious to me that everyone who just gets a little drunk does that. A lot of the times people get drunk and have the wherewithal to say, I'm not going to drive. But like alcoholics drive drunk all the fucking time, because the real issue is that darkness within them. That threatens to take them out and maybe other people as well.
Yeah, it's like playing chicken with the devil a little bit. We'll get into let's get into Gerard for a sec, because I think you read I See Satan Fall Like Lightning over
that's right
channel, right? Which is an interesting place to start with him, because I think that's almost like mid Gerard when he starts getting actually into the Christian message and stuff. That where am I going to go with this? Help me out here.
We're talking about within I See Satan Fall Like Lightning, we explained it as sort of the mimetic crisis, because people hear the term mimetic crisis or even mimesis, and you know, maybe it's used in other ways, but a lot of it comes back to this about what happens when sort of mimetics gets hijacked by something sinister. And in the case of Gerard, he's saying that is that not only is Satan responsible for that, that is Satan. Like Satan is manifested as this virus of conflict. So that's how he proposes it. And then this, it threatens to destroy a community. There's actually this other great book called Political Ponerology. And it's got some Polish author whose name I'm not even going to try. And is this guy, he's like his background is he lived through the Third Reich and also lived through the Soviet Union. So his obsession was tracking the spread of what he called evil. But he also says evil is essentially sort of mental illness. There's this psychosis that pollutes an organization or a society, and mental illness spreads unless you stop it. And you could see this evident in the Soviet Union, where it's paranoia, and it's what causes individuals to rat out their neighbors and their children to the state. It's everyone kind of going crazy on an individual level like that. It's like, what is that? That they were made this way through the spread of some contagion. Now, Gerard would say, well, that's Satan. Other people would say that's evil. In a sense, because he's saying like evil spreads and makes other people evil, and sometimes has a core to it, but kind of transforms society that way until it destroys everything. And what Gerard says, for those who don't know, and you can cut me off at any time here if I'm just going too far, he says, and this is the interesting part, that the crisis, the mimetic crisis, is conflict that threatens to destroy the entire community. It usually starts with two people with some, he says it kind of starts with envy. You covet thy neighbor's ox or whatever. And then it turns into bitterness, and that turns into a feud, and that turns into violence. And then it turns into this big fucking thing. And it threatens to destroy the community, maybe the society, but let's just say community, town. And then, but it needs a pressure release. And that pressure release in this model, and I'm not sure I agree entirely with this, but within this model, the pressure release would be a scapegoat. You find an individual to blame the conflict on, kill them, sacrifice them, exile them, usually kill them. Pressure release achieved. Everything goes back to normal. In Gerard's model, he says this is all the work of Satan is conflict, but then Satan also elects a sacrifice to kind of quell it, to bring it back down to baseline, so it can keep sort of, you know, in essence, milking that suffering for eternity. So he says, I think somewhere near the end of the book, he says Satan causes the conflict, but also gives people the way out, so it can kind of keep, you know, in flux forever and just kind of milking that suffering from humanity. Well, I mean,
that was the God trap, right? That was the Christ trap for Satan. When, yeah. You know, I think people look at the temptations of Christ in the desert, and they don't understand. It's like Christ is trying to, Satan is like not sure. He's not sure what this Christ kid's all about, right? Whether he's just a prophet or whether he's, you know, what's going on. But never in his mind does he actually think this is actually God inhabiting a human form that's humbling himself to this point, because that's outside of of myth, that's outside of all structure. Like, no God had ever done that before. It's not that gods haven't come down in human form, but it's like Zeus comes down in human form, fucks around, you know, out pops Hercules, right? You know, Yahweh had never, that was just outside of frame. So Satan didn't really think this was actually God in a human form. He just thought it was a God had made this prophet, and that's why he's trying to tempt him all the time.
And that's also what's very interesting. Sorry to cut you off there, but yeah. Before I forget, what's interesting about Lord of the Rings? Everyone's familiar with Lord of the Rings, but if you're like me and you get weird with it,
what is it? Is this like a Jewish jewelry thing?
Bud?
Is it right next to the dreidel store? It's like
the
dreidel Lord of the Rings.
The fucking
Olympics. Give us your gold. Give us your gold and your silver. Come.
What the fuck is this guy talking about?
Hard times. What? Just take out a tooth. Give it over. We'll give you some money. Like a little bit of shekel.
But before I forget, it was a lot of people. There's all kinds of video essays out there and experts in Lord of the Rings. You can watch them. And one of the interesting points in the book is that this is essentially what led to the destruction of Sauron at the end of The Return of the King. What really defeated him was his hubris. What really defeated him was his arrogance, that he was shocked when the hobbits were at the crack of Mount Doom, and it never occurred to him, because he was so sure that was just impossible. And so, and knowing what you know about J.R.R. Tolkien and where he draws his inspiration from, like, that does seem to be drawn from, I think, you know, Christianity, in a sense that the evil is defeated not by something that can outsmart it, but it's almost defeated by its own faults, in a sense. And I'm sure there's other, you know, theologians out there that can probably say it better than that, but that's just what I always found interesting.
Well, I mean, it's even Star Wars, right? Like, it's the thermal exhaust pipe, right, that brings down the Empire. And even in the third film, where it's like, you know, they just don't think of it. Like,
yeah,
well, why wouldn't you consider this option? Why? Pretty obvious option. What if this isn't working? I was like, no, it's gonna work out.
Yeah,
it's kind of like what we're saying. Like, I've coined the term bitter white pill. To kind of like, I imagine it like sort of the fisherman friend version of a white pill, where you take it, you're like, oh, this is disgusting. You're like, yeah, but it's good. It's fine. It's working. It's a good thing, but it's disgusting at the same time. Is that our elites are fucking retarded, and there's no reason to be afraid of them. Peter Kononis has talked about this. Like, if you're big into the JQ and you think that, you know, the Jews run everything and they're in control of all this stuff, and then you look around and everything's, and like planes are falling from the sky, like, oh, so they just suck at it. Like, there's opportunities here, folks, is kind of what we're saying.
There's opportunities. There's one book I've mentioned before, and some people are probably sick of me bringing it up, but just when we're talking about this, about how evil can sometimes be self-defeating, I'm cautious about going too down that road, because some people will take that road to pacifism and say, well, it doesn't matter what we do, because eventually evil will, or corruption, whatever it might be, will wear itself out, and because that's in its nature. The fear is that by the time it quote unquote wears itself out, it's just leveled everything. And there's this book I mentioned, it's by a lot of your listeners might be aware of it. It's by Ivan Ilyin, called On Resistance to Evil by Force. Mm-hmm. And this is Orthodox guy. And he's taken, he wrote the entire book, not the entire book, but at least the first half, in response to Tolstoy. Another one of three famous Russians. And then
there's only three.
Yeah, but he was pacifist. He was on the side of like, any violence is the work of Satan. Any violence is evil. You should actually lay down and maybe even sacrifice yourself and let evil steamroll you, with the belief that eventually good will win, God will win. Ivan Ilyin was saying that, no, you have a duty to confront evil with force, sometimes even violence, but by force. You must apprehend it and interrogate it. And so it was like a treatise against pacifism. And even with, I believe a lady here said, the Andrew Labazuski, the guy who did that political ponerology book, that's kind of the argument he was making, that like, you need to stop it, otherwise it will consume everything. Just like within Gerard's, like without that pressure release of the scapegoat, then everyone just kind of fucking kills each other. Then maybe you don't have anything. That's the fear. So my fear is that, you know, if our opponents are inept, surely they are, but how much damage can they do before they destroy themselves? You know, if planes are falling out, like what can we do to make it so the planes don't fall on my house?
Well, yeah, I think what's gotten confused with being a pacifist, is that somehow people think that it means self-sacrifice suspending someone's your natural desire for self-preservation. I don't think that's true. It's you have to kind of look at your moves. Like being a pacifist as a first priority is fine, right? Like if you can move, if instead of engaging in violence, instead of engaging in a conflict, if you can detach yourself from the conflict and remove yourself, a lot of good things can happen, right? Like always look to get yourself out of it. If the conflict is here and you can't do anything else but confront it, then you have to confront it, because your self-preservation has to take primacy. And as a father, I remember when my child was first born, and I've shared this story before, so bear with anyone who actually listens to what I'm talking about, is that I remember when they moved my wife and my newborn daughter from the delivery room to the recovery room, and I got into that room and I started checking my sixes and nines. And I became very aware of this sort of impulse that if anyone came into that room threateningly, I would take their life, right? And there's like this, like it's this, you know, shoulder up kind of move. And if you're, that's a natural and good response that shouldn't be questioned or subdued. Like you need to have that response to your family and to yourself, to saying like, this is more important than me, right? Like it's almost more important than my goodness or my soul. Like you have to have things that are bigger and more important, because if you don't, you get into the sophistry of individualism, where it's all about you and everyone else be damned.
It's not just your posture. It's not just your machismo that you're here for. It's not that you are saying, I would rise to the occasion because you want to be a hero, but you are right. 100% convinced that you would. You would, if someone broke into your house, you would grab the gun. And right. I don't know, like there are fathers out there who wouldn't do that. I don't know what to say to them, honestly. Like, they're missing something, or they're so ideologically possessed that they think this, like, sacrificing their family would serve whatever cause it is. But, like, I think there is a biological, spiritual, metaphysical drive. And women experience that with the whole mama bear thing. You know, they talk about that all the time. But, yeah, with... Even when the phrasing people use when they say, oh, if you don't have any kids, you don't have stakes in society. I never liked that. And that seems hostile to people without kids. But there is something in that where your time horizon changes and your relationship with society changes, because now you feel like, oh, I'm representing a household, not just me, not just a consumer, not just a guy out there who's looking for something. And then I think for a man, viewing himself as a member of a household, you know, I'm not trying to throw salt on any divorced individuals, but I think they know what I'm talking about here. You know, you see yourself as part of a unit, even if you divorce the fucking mother of your children or father of your children, like there's still a connection there. Yeah.
You never stop being married to your wife if you have kids. Like, yeah, it's impossible. You're still married, you're co-parenting and you're scheduling things with her and you have to figure things out with her and you're talking with her all the time because you know you have to figure out school and payments, all that stuff. Yeah, you're still married. You're just not living together. Like, that's the only thing.
Well, it's like, why do we know that? Because these people find it so difficult to date single people, and single people don't want to date, you know, single parents, because they know there's like this other phantom thing there that they'll have to wrestle their entire lives to, you know, reach the same level of.
Have you ever tried dating a single mother? I dated a single mother for like 3 months, like years and years ago, obviously.
How'd it go? Was it great?
No, it was awful. It's like, you know, and I was like, okay, I'm going to man up and like be the surrogate father to this kid who, like, it's not my kid. And all I can hear about is her shit with her ex. I'm like, this isn't fun. Like, you know, like, even if the sex was good, it's like, it's not that good. It's like, no sex is that good.
And also there's a wall there. And that's something, because, you know, my dad died when I was pretty young. And so my mom was a widower, would start, because she had a long-term relationship at one point, but there always is this kind of strange there. You're never sure if that guy is allowed to discipline the children in any way,
right?
It's like, what, that's never talked about. It's like a weird thing that's always there and never really goes away unless it's kind of negotiated between the guy and that kid. But it's like this whole thing.
Well, and also, here's the thing that happens quite often, and I think this happens quite often. You'll see with women more explicitly, but I've seen it with men as well. Like, my mom and my dad divorced when I was very young. My mom had one long-term relationship when I was growing up with this guy called Guy. You're fucking dick. I know.
I don't know why.
Wasn't even Guy. He wasn't even fucking French. He was just from New Brunswick. So it's just called Guy.
It's not sure. What could that possibly be short for either? Like,
exactly. Like, Guillaume? Like, but no, but he's English, so he's Guy. And he was, you know, emotion abusive and all that kind of good stuff. And I saw it in that relationship. It's like he became rivalrous with me. Now I'm a, you know, 8-year-old kid, but he was becoming jealous of the affection my mom was showing to her own child because obviously he wanted it. And I started thinking about this in terms of, like, I think a lot of divorced women, you see that too, where the standard refrain a lot of divorced women will say that, oh yeah, my ex was a lousy husband, but he's a great dad. And I'm sure that can happen, but I also think that a lot of times what happens is that child gets born, the father begins to become, giving love to the child, and the mother is put into a rivalrous situation with her child, which is very uncomfortable because, you know, she loves her child. The husband loves her child. This is a good thing, but she becomes jealous of her husband's split of affections. Like, she's used to getting all of it. Now she has to share it. She doesn't like that, and so they get divorced. Because even in that statement, lousy husband, great father. I'm like, I don't know how you could do that. Like, to be a good father, most of the primary characteristics of a good father, in my mind, also makes you a good husband. Like,
yeah. And with it also factors in that the gender of the kids too, because that can sometimes affect the relationship as well. I find that with a lot of people now, and I don't know how far this goes back in history, but they're always chasing this sort of romantic high, chasing that dragon. And when my son was born, I think even my wife might have been surprised at how things changed. And part of being married is trying to reclaim those times when you could have time for yourself. Date right. nights and couples time and stuff. But she was even ways like, you know, like everything changed. I'm like, yeah, like I think some people go into starting a family not really believing that everything's going to change. They might understand it logically, but they don't really believe it. And then once they're there, they panic. They don't know what to do. Like, oh, like the attention split. Like they never ran that through their operating system. And so they, you know what I mean? But it seems obvious, but a lot of people don't. And so they think it's like, oh, he's a good father, but a good husband. Well, at when a kid's born, you're kind of both at the same time. You don't get to say, I wish he was more one of this other thing. Same with a mother.
Right.
Like being married to a mother, it's a different creature entirely, not only emotionally, but physically too. Woman's body changes all over the fucking place, right? Hormones are different. So it's like, this is a new room I'm living in right now. And I think those who go into it understanding that do a better job at staying together.
Yeah. Yeah, and sort of understand. Also, I think people who just have who actually have love, you know, I think what's surprising to me, I'm 47. I shouldn't, or turning 47 this year. I shouldn't be this naive, but occasionally you get these instances where you're like, oh shit, people don't really understand this, do they? Like they don't get love. They don't really understand what it means to like sacrifice or actually believe that there's something more important than them, which I would think is like fucking basic. But then you run into people like you're running your whole life like as if this doesn't exist, as if this concept is like, I'm talking astrophysics, like, you know, showing magic to a dog, like, just talking to an average Australian about, you know, anything bigger than their day. Like it's stunning to me. Like, what was the other assumption I was thinking about today? The other day so part of what got me where I'm at was a realization, because I was a standard, you know, shit lib Canadian boy, living in a 90s frame for way too long. And one of the things that happened was I became aware that I had stacked all these contradictions, these mental contradictions in my head. And it was a George Floyd protests that were happening in Canada that finally broke me, because I was watching. I was an atheist at the time. I was watching outside my duplex window into a park, a whole bunch of people kneeling in solidarity with George Floyd in Montreal, Canada, like during a pandemic. Like, you know, I was watching this weird civic religion ceremony happening outside my window. And I was like, I can no longer make sense of this. Like, you know, the pandemic was one of the big ones, right? I was just running on this assumption that everyone was kind of good, right? Like, in general, Canadians were all, you know, Canadians are Canadians, Canadians are Canadian. Yes, we have our bad people. They're the people who just didn't receive the message. But overall, everyone's bottom line pretty decent and going to take care of each other. And then during that whole period of time, I was like, oh no, we're not good. Like, this is weird. And then the George Floyd thing happened. Like, I'm done. Like, I had almost like a cascade failure.
Well, that's good. That's what most people should do, because, you know, the George Floyd, what we call the summer of love, that would have radicalized, I think, a lot of normal people. But for people like us, it drove us insane. Just like COVID, it radicalized a lot of people. But if you're already in that space, it probably pushed you to some fringe that you've just never left at that point. So I imagine that's also what people must have felt like during the Rodney King riots. Like, you didn't think this was possible. Then you're witnessing it, and then you're watching the media reaction to it. And then the cascade failure you experience is what you would hope most people experience, because they're seeing something that their ideology said shouldn't be happening. And then if the people you hate were talking about this. So maybe those people that I was against, maybe they were right about other things. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what the red pilling is. You start that inquest of self-discovery saying, wait, what the fuck else might I have been wrong? And if you start probing your thoughts and your history, some people just don't do that. Some people just say this was a weird, like with COVID, a lot of people think, well, that was like a weird one-off thing that happened. But, you know, if you have any sort of intellectual fucking curiosity, you would say, that's kind of crazy that happened. Has that happened before? What are the mechanisms that led to that? They said it wasn't developed in a lab and they called me everyone crazy. Then they admitted to it. That's a weird thing that happened. Have they done that with other diseases? Like, if you pull that thread, now you're at the entire fucking tapestry of government conspiracies and you can get lost in there. And it's kind of up to each individual where they stop. You can keep pulling that thread and end up at the earth is flat too. You can go all the way to the end where you distrust anything ever reported by the media.
I've been there, man. Hey man, dinosaurs are the most fake and gay thing in the world.
Like one of my good friends is Johnny Monoxide from the Paranormies. And he's every day I talk about a female celebrity. He's like, oh, you know, they're trans, right? I'm like, yeah, I know. I know every woman's trans. I know, I get. But he's like, Earth is flat, all science, space is fake, nukes are fake, and he's got 100 hours of content and all of it. So, you know, I'm not like, he's good friends with me, so I'm not even trying to dismiss any of that. But a lot of people end up there, and people wonder why have so many people ended up there. And it's just because if you believe you've been lied to by so many things, well, why not everything? So even if you don't believe necessarily in all that stuff, I think it's important to understand how people get there. And it's not just they're schizophrenic. You know, same thing with QAnon people. I know it's easy to dunk on QAnon people and think it's ridiculous, but you can chart a course for how and this is kind of a marketing thing. This is where you look at a demographic and see how they change over time. You see, okay, here's a group of people, probably Gen X. They were like solidly political. And something made them believe that politics is fake. None of it matters. And they spiraled and they ended up in some weird areas. But something triggered that. And they asked, why not? Well, why not? Why isn't fucking Trump on the side of Christ? And like, they didn't know what the deep state was. Then you learn what the deep state is and you freak the fuck out. So you can see over the course of years how they kind of end up there, which I think is essential for figuring out how to talk to them and maybe not correct, but introduce some new information that says, oh, maybe, you know, Donald Trump isn't going to like make every, you know, the reason I'm Canadian, I can't vote for Trump, but I would have voted for Trump because I thought he was going to throw every single woman in America out of a helicopter. Unfortunately, he didn't do that. But you know, like, but there's
he's going to grab him by the pussy and just like a six pack.
Yeah. He's going to blow up Mecca. He's going to, you know, there's some people who like kind of believe that, but I see reasonable people. Because if you look at the demographics, if you look at the biomass, you say, well, these people have jobs, they have families, they actually seem to have everything else in their lives figured out. They're not retarded. They're not actually insane. So what's going on there? And I think people in our space can be a bit too dismissive. And that's how you argue yourself into very, very dark corners. And some people think I'm just a, I'm a big bleeding heart softy wanting to talk to these people, but I guess I am, you know.
Well, no, but I think there's rationale to it. Like it's to go back to Gerard for a second. Like we always create these little mental scapegoats, because what a scapegoat essentially does is remove responsibility from us. Like responsibility and resentment are intimately connected. That the more resentment you have, the less responsibility you want to take about it, because this is all like pride all the way down, right? That Father Turbo Quails once said something that really illuminated me when he said that depression is actually a form of pride, because it comes down to saying like, why aren't things working out for me? You know, I or even this sort of self-hatred, like I'm horrible because somewhere in my brain I have a preferred state to be it. I should be better than this. It's that whole statement. It's like, how do you know that? How are you making this? How are you making that rationale? How do you know what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, or next week or 5 years from now? Why do you think you should be in control of this? So we create these little mini scapegoats, and we apply all these social ills and problems to them so that we don't have to deal with our own problem. When I started saying with civilizational capital is that you don't live in a civilization anymore. People, the reaction to that was really interesting to me because people really get defensive about it. Like they're almost trying to negotiate the statement. I'm like, no. You have to start from an a priori. So you might as well start from here. You might as well assume zero and work up. It's the same thing as like whatever's going on in your life, you're the problem. Fix it. Because if you assume this that position and say that I am the one who's making this problem a problem, you can fix that. You can fix you. Even that comes down to like I'm going to remove myself from that situation, not through maids, but but like you know from by just somebody saying I'll quit or I'll leave or I'll do this or whatever, right? Like you have options. People just think they don't have them because they have this romanticized vision in their head that they have to do this or do that or go through therapy and stuff. Like, no, just, you know, maybe the best situation is to get yourself out of it, remove yourself from it. And then all of a sudden things can sometimes get better. Like you don't have to sacrifice. If you're the scapegoat in the situation, you don't have to get sacrificed. You do have to perform a sacrifice, but it doesn't necessarily have to be you getting murdered. You can also just remove yourself. And oftentimes that just makes things better in a weird way. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple things there. One on the topic of psychiatry, one of the issues that's plaguing, I think, a lot of people right now, men, women, old, young, is the over psychiatric analyzation of each other and ourselves. And we cover this very interesting book by a man named Thomas Szasz, who wrote a book called The Therapeutic State. This was a renowned psychologist, and he was sort of tracking the history of how psychoanalysis infiltrated, because it didn't happen that long ago, American society.
No early life check required for that name.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to Freud, but Freud is relatively recent. And you think that it was this movement done by hundreds of people. It never is. It's usually only like 3 to 6 guys who are in charge of most of these intellectual movements. But that's resulted in all of us psychoanalyzing each other and ourselves. I forget the guy's name. Dr. Menninger, I think, was his name. He was the leading psychoanalyst in America at the time. And his position was nobody is sane. There is no such thing as sanity. We're all just different gradations of insane. That's very interesting because that means you don't have a baseline that you want to work back to. Everyone is permanently insane. It's just trying to figure out how to either chemically or therapeutically cope with that. But you're kind of infecting society with this madness that has no ideal state. Like, how do you get back to sanity? Well, that's impossible. But also I wanted to mention here, there's a very, very good comment here by Cable. Like, did we just come full circle to pull yourself up by your bootstraps? I wanted to address that because that was what we mentioned before. Jordan Peterson was big on, but clean your room. And I think a lot of leftists correctly point out, like, look, you're not to blame for everything. Sometimes there is just social oppression. Sometimes there are phenomenon forces beyond your control, economically, academically, whatever it is. I do think, though, that for a great many things, most people know what they need to do to be who they want to be. It's no great mystery. And I find that if you address those first, you can become the sort of agent of change that can attack those things. And on the right, broadly, we're pretty good at that. We have a rich and long history of self-improvement, of fitness. I actually think physique posting, as corny as it is one of the better things we've done. Look, not everyone needs to be a bodybuilder, but understanding that wouldn't it be cool if you were in shape and you could just like flex and just own someone that way? You know, it's kind of a bit people do, but we're pretty good on pushing discipline. We're pretty good on pushing nutrition and eating healthy and getting the plastic out of your blood, all that shit. We're pretty good at that. And I think that helps you put yourself in a position where you can address those larger problems, as opposed to some on the left politically who think self-improvement is fascist or bad, and they kind of lean into the sickness, lean into the mental illness. So I don't like throwing the baby out with the bathwater, where it's like there's a certain level most people can rise to make themselves not miserable. And sometimes it's fucking easy. Sometimes it does mean not drinking, and sometimes it does mean not eating so many seed oils. All the memes on our side, usually it's like three or four things. If you do that, you actually will feel better. If you work out, you will feel better and clearer, and you can plan better. You know, anyway, that was a bit of a,
you know, rant. I just started, Dave Gronowski said this on our last show together, and he's like, you know, just go fix your thyroid. And I've been meaning to fix my thyroid for a little bit. I started fixing my thyroid, and I kind of just tell everyone, go fix your fucking thyroid. It's amazing. Like, I was clouded and feeling crappy like all the time, but no reason or rhyme to it. I started taking thyroid tablets and just like garden variety, whatever, like nothing special about them. And within a week, I'm like, way better.
Yeah, it's a lot of these little adjustments will make you clear, and then you can address these big problems a lot better. So you can turn yourself into that sort of warrior that you want to be, whatever it might be. But so I kind of walk the line between those two things.
Logan Daly just gives a 10 2-bit podcast memberships. Thank you very much, Logan Daly. I will take your nubs and your money. I appreciate you. Dimes are coming up. We're over an hour. Can we keep you around for a little bit longer? I don't know.
Just a few more minutes, actually, because I do need to get going to have dinner, but I am having such a great time. I want to push it. Garbage is best song, by the way. Sorry.
Where else do you want to go with it? Shane Gillis is one of your, just to finish off with the Bud Light comedian. See, there's points to all these things, folks. We kind of weave this shit in so that, you know, I don't know. It's an art. You wouldn't get it. You said to me when we were talking about it coming up to the show, is that Shane Gillis is one of your boys now. He now is the new comedian spokesman for Bud Light. Bud Light, of course, got themselves in a little bit of trouble by going with a trans spokesperson. And then when that blew up their face, they decided to switch gears. And now they're all UFC and
even by trans standards, a real freak of nature. Dylan Mulvaney is the individual, like, just unsettling to behold for most people.
Yeah, because it's a, because all trans is this weird. So Gerard talks about modeling and mirroring. There's almost a distinction to be made, right? Modeling is what kind of what your kid does with you. They're looking at you and they're adopting your mannerisms, your ways of doing it, like to a personalized level. Mirroring is what happens often, and this, we see this a lot now with social media, is where people are just taking the facade. So they're, it's almost like a caricature would be a better way of thinking about it. So almost all male to female trans are doing sort of like female caricatures. It's drag in a weird way.
Yeah. Or it's even worse than that. Just to do a brief tangent there, I always encourage people to look at some of these larger sweeping problems as buckets containing smaller problems. So even the trans identity, I kind of reject that identity as we know it, because if you look at it, it's actually a few component pathologies that have different causes. So on one hand, maybe there are people who are transgender. I'm not even going to give them that. I think it's fucking bullshit. Because what you have on one hand is autogynephiles. So autogynephile, I think that would constitute most of the ones you actually do see, male to female. They are just
they're like the ultra Jews. It's like, you know, where circumcision just isn't enough. They're like, no further. Well, I need more.
In a sense, what they are is a man who is turned on by the idea of them being a woman. So oftentimes they don't even get the surgery because that's part of it. If you'll notice, there's lots of trans influencers who never get bottom surgery, and they'll kind of create this reason why. And I'm, you know, I don't encourage people to do. Yeah, exactly. I don't encourage people to do. Blair White's a great example because that's bimbofication all the way down. That's like you became like a weird, like tarted up sex doll as a man. So, but that is what it is. And I don't encourage people to do this, but you can find forums, Reddit, subreddits of like the wives of guys who go through this. And I always remember this one where like the wife was talking about, like, I found my husband in our room, like wearing lingerie, staring at himself in the mirror, and he had an erection. That is essentially who you're dealing with here. They are an extreme fetishist who is into the idea of like being a man who's also a woman. So it's a fetish. It's not an identity. And that's where a lot of these women, I think, get confused. It's like, this doesn't seem like what you're saying. This seems sick and weird because it is. Then there's the cross dressers who are a bit different, like that, just like gay men who dress as women. That's a bit different as well. But then there's just the straight up predators too that are doing it just to like get to kids, the groomers. So these are just men who grow their hair and say, I'm a woman now and you can't get mad at me. That's like a third group. But this is all bound up in this identity that's essentially made up psychoanalytically.
And that subgroup of the men who are trying to, who are predators, is it men who I think are realizing, hey, women get all these extra benefits. So all I have to do is identify as a woman and I get all these benefits. I can win gold at the fucking Olympics.
Precisely. So a lot of this is the fucking dark shadow of feminism teaching men. It's like, I want attention. I want to be loved. Like a lot of these, you know, it's fucking great. Look, if you have the patience for this, look at the interviews with the Wachowskis. So there's two with the directors of The Matrix, both male to female trans, doing an awful job at it. But the way they got into it was watching trans porn and this being sort of a humiliation ritual for them.
Don't just as advice for any trans people listening to this, don't make your model Whoopi Goldberg. Because that's essentially what Wachowskis look like. They look like white Whoopi Goldbergs, and not like Jumping Jack Flash Whoopi Goldberg. I'm talking like View Whoopi Goldberg right now, you know.
But it's like these were very insecure, dark, weird guys who I think, and this is just me reaching a bit here, but a lot of these guys I think glorify the idea of the woman as the receiver of praise, the receiver of attention. So they decide they want to be a woman because they want all this free stuff, and then they don't get it. But they kind of get it from women, because the funny thing is that men don't really have patience for how women do things. But, you know, if you are married or you've raised daughters or anything, or you know women and like to be around them or whatever, you kind of know that they do this thing where they lie all the fucking time, but they deal in revealed preference. So this is why, for example, I always use the example of Miley Cyrus. Like she was out there years ago saying that I'm pansexual. I'm open to dating anyone, man, woman, trans, whatever. But she always dated the exact same type of straight white man. Because when it comes to most women, you actually have to look at what they do, because they'll say stuff. They'll say like, I love transgender, they're strong, they're powerful. If you call that woman, if you say that she looks transgender, she'll try and shoot you in your fucking throat because she understands that's ugly and weird and freakish, but she won't say that. So, and a lot of men don't understand that. So they think when a woman says, oh, you're gorgeous and beautiful, that's also what hot girls say to fat girls too. They say you're gorgeous, and they pick one thing that they like. It's like, oh, you're gorgeous, your boobs are so big. Yeah, because she's 400 fucking pounds. It would be weird if they weren't. But guys think like, oh, they love me. They love me because they don't know how to think like a woman. And that's the weird irony there.
Cable with a $49.99 super chat. Thank you very much, Cable. Female to male trans unironically perpetrating, promoting gender stereotypes as long as you're a dude. Purposeful inversion. You know what's sick and wrong about all this stuff is that, and I would love to be on the side of someone who thinks like, hey man, if you're over 18, no problem. But the problem with that is that, again, once you become a father and you're serious about being a father, you realize that that's your child forever. Like 18 isn't a magic wand, right? If my daughter. I'm thankful that my daughter is turning out to be a girly girl, even at 3.5. Like, she's, you know, very, very, very femme in many ways. And like, that's almost like a sigh of relief, where if you have a daughter who's a tomboy, you're like, now you're worried, like, what if I have some third grade teacher who wants to be a savior of the world, who identifies my kid as trans, and then starts issuing them puberty blockers at, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, whatever fucking stupid age that they're pushing this shit on. That's the concern. But also the further concern is that it doesn't stop when you're 18. Like, I don't want anyone to have to deal or go through this. Like, this is insanity. Like, they're literally pushing castration medication onto people, and I don't expect that most of the people would either want to be parents or be good parents in the first place. I'm not promoting them to have children necessarily, but at the same time, it's like, this is sick and wrong, and you're not going to fix this by doing more sick and wrong things to people.
Yeah, well, and I like the phrasing of sick and wrong, and this is always what got libertarians.
Thank you. It's my phrase. You can use it if you want.
You invented sick and wrong.
It was always mine. Other people used it before me, but actually, they were just referencing me. Look,
there was a first guy to put peanut butter and jelly together. So it's two great
like
things.
I don't know. I don't know if you know this, but I'm like wicked smart. Like, I'm really
no. He's becoming trans. This is what happens when you talk about it. It's a cognito hazard.
It's just faking gay all of a sudden.
You latch onto sick and wrong, and I think this is what libertarians would always get stuck in, this mind trap, because they would have their opponents get them into these logic puzzles where it's like, well, they're a grown up; they should be able to do what they want to do, and then they get stuck in the age of consent argument, and then it's over. Right. But come back to baseline. This is weird and sick and wrong, and everyone knows it. And maybe I don't need to get into a debate about it. I'm going to yell at you until you fucking go away. And I think most people are at that point right now. And it doesn't need to be another logic puzzle. Like, this is sick, and I don't like it. And you don't need to feel bad or inferior because you haven't written a fucking thesis paper explaining and citing sources about why you feel this way. You're allowed to just understand. You're allowed to be reactionary. People think that's a bad thing, but I think that's a good thing to be for most people. If you see a tranny and you're repulsed, don't run away from that. Don't get stuck into an ideological Gordian knot because, like, well, why do you feel this way? I'm allowed to. And, you know, the way you would go about it is like, okay, let's say you're in a public square and anyone's allowed free speech in the public square, but there's one guy who keeps screaming that he wants to rape your child. That's legal. But am I allowed? Should enough people be allowed to, like, beat that guy to death? Yeah. And that's actually how you know you're in a healthy fucking society. Sometimes you need people behaving unreasonably if reason has been hijacked by something corrupt. If something has been corrupted, the solution to that will look ridiculous sometimes. But I think actually right now there's enough percolating hatred towards the trans community that I think most people are, like, my prediction, I shouldn't make predictions. That's a fool's errand. Gonna do it anyway.
That's what I do all the time. Don't worry.
When people talk about putting the woke away, there's a running bet between Academic Agent and Orrin McIntyre about, are we going to see
the title? That's the title of this episode. It's a good thing we actually got to it by the end of it.
I'm a great guest. Dude, a lot of people don't know this.
Just
look, everyone just appreciate me for a second. But putting the woke way, it's like, well, no, because will policies be reversed? No. Will the status quo be inverted? No. There is one morsel they will give you, and that will be the trans phenomena. But my prediction is that will ultimately be blamed on white people. And it pains me to say that, but there will be a day when everyone shakes their heads like, that was a weird thing we did. What? Who's to blame for that? It was Karens. And I use that phrase with the full anger and sense of injustice, because I do think that's just like an anti-white thing for white women, just blaming things on white women. Like, I bet the trans thing is going to be blamed on white women, and they're just going to take all the minority groups are going to say that this was just a weird thing they forced on us, and that will be the woke being put away, but it will be another oppressive thing. That's my belief anyway. I've said that before. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, and my prediction, I've even called Jason's apple pie prediction, and it's really comes down to understanding Girard memetics, is that the differentiation has gone so far that it has to swing to something new. So where's the differentiation from the woke? It'll be neo-trads, right? So, and this is my answer to that, you know, putting the woke away thing. It's not so much the woke will go away, it'll be transformed or transcended into the neo-trad, where you're going to keep most, if not all, the general principles. Like Blair White will still exist and be allowed to exist. Dave Rubin will become almost a poster child, where it's like, that's going to be the new acceptable homosexual relationship, right? Where gay pride will go back to being just like an observation rather than like get the porn off the streets. It'll be like more sensible gay couples wearing sweater vests, buying children, like and I predict that in a very short period of time, I think it's happening faster than I even initially thought, is that all those blue haired progressive people in your family or you know, extended whatever, will one day wake up and become wearing frocks and talking about apple pie recipes and become this new neo-trad thing, which I think now is actually going to be somehow modeling Peter Thiel, who is homosexual, but you wouldn't know that without Gawker. You know, sensible, like almost sensible gay. Like AA talks about the sensible centrist. I'm talking about sensible homosexuality in a sense.
Yeah. For people who want to pay attention to this, I'm going to give one recommendation. And this is a very complex issue. I do need to get going soon. But if people want to see where this normalization will emerge from, one will be the red pill dating sphere. Mm-hmm. That's my prediction. A lot of sort of weird anti-woman stuff might come from there. Not right now, not like taking aim at like Fresh and Fit or the whatever podcast, but there's something kind of percolating in the red pill dating sphere. The other will
Andrew
be the
Tate. Andrew Tate has been way too massive of a memetic influence to be ignored. So
So I will say Andrew Tate, who I do not like, would be mainly responsible for that, but not like, you know, getting a bunch of hoes on a panel and laughing at them. That's fine. That'll be fine forever. But then, the other one would be the vitalism sphere. These would be, you know, like a lot of the blank age, blank people. Again, no one in particular, but there is sort of a percolating homosexuality coming from that sphere. And it won't look like what it looked like before, but it will be like, it will look at what elements of tradition it's attacking. And what it might be attacking is actually what the traditional family, in a lot of ways, that's how it's going to begin. So watch those two spheres and watch the arguments emerging from those spheres, because the fact of the matter is that leftism intellectually doesn't have a lot going on right now, despite what people say. Noam Chomsky is being fucking stomped into the ground right now in front of everyone. It's almost sad.
I love to see it. It's sad, but it's elder abuse, but it's the proper one.
There's a lot of interest in this side of things. There's money that is a bit interested in us too. A lot of eyeballs, a lot of new fresh faces who are more interested in this. However, that can also lead to corruption. So when you talk about tradition, trad can be a fandom. Realize what is true and what is actually the what is vitalizing versus what is just a fandom. You know, like the wheat field thing. Like, I want a trad woman. Well, what subsequent components make up someone that is trad? A lot of people don't ask themselves. It's just a fandom. It's just an image. It's just, I saw this in a movie and I'm chasing it. But they haven't thought about what they actually want at the baseline, what qualities they want, and what qualities are possible right now. You know, because you can maybe have, a lot of people would say having a dual income house isn't trad. But for a lot of people, like in Canada, no one can afford a house. Like the circumstances and the constraints will dictate whether or not certain parts are realistic. So you need to figure out what part of trad. Is it just economic? Is it just LARPing? Or is it something deeper? And I would always encourage people to look at what's deeper, because it's those deeper things that are going to end up questioned. It's the fundamental relationships between men and women that will be attacked. or what role men should play in society and what masculinity is. That's the stuff that's being reworked, but it has this sort of, oh, remember when we used to be happy? Don't you want to, wasn't the Bronze Age cool? You have no fucking idea what it's like to be in the Bronze Age. You have no fucking idea.
Or the 1950s, which is like the right of return for almost all conservatives. Like, I think a lot of this stuff is to get the evangelicals on board, because the Jews realize they've lost, they're starting to lose people in the West. And their core supporters are even right-wing evangelicals.
Yeah, yeah. Also, keep in mind, once the boomers pass on, the whole table gets wiped clean. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but you're going to, there's a lot of things that are kept in place socially by boomers that won't be there anymore. Like, for example, news media is going to fucking crater. That means a lot more than people think. Mm-hmm. There's going to be one less pillar that people can kind of gather around, even conceptually.
So no more classified ads and papers. That'll be weird.
Yeah. Anyway, I actually do need to get going now. Okay. Unfortunately, I've had a fantastic time. We could even talk about this for another hour. I'd love to come back if you would have me.
Just do it, man. We'll schedule in. Dimes, let everyone know where to find you, and we'll get you out of here.
Check out bloodsatellite.ca to find all the episodes of the show. I'm also on Twitter at Legally Ironic. Follow me on there. I also run this a writing site called the Vanguardist Journal. It's vanguardistjournal.com. So I publish a lot of longer form articles there. But bloodsatellite.ca is the main site. You can access all the clips, all the everything for the show.
It's a fantastic site. All the links are on the description below.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Dimes. We will talk to you guys again soon. ¶¶